there?
What happened there? I don't know. I really don't know. She got tired of me. I don't know what. I can't tell you. And, you know, other people have theories. They're not my theory. One of the things was a purported affair that she had, which I'm not sure that it was or what, but it had involved people in the cheese business and the rumors and gossip, and she was very angry at me because she thought I started it, which I certainly didn't.
Right.
But there were a lot of her parents got ill and eventually died, and she changed. I mean, she got very heavy, and her personality changed incredibly much.
And that's after this interview with Bancroft. It's 98, 99.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Right.
You know, there were problems that we disagreed about our son.
Were you living in Creskill at that time?
Yep.
Yeah.
Still, yeah.
The place where I was.
Same house.
Same house?
Yeah. No, not the same house.
Oh. So that, in Creskill, you lived there for most of your cheese life?
Yep.
Yeah. What is Creskill noted for? Anything? I mean, historically?
Historically, it's noted for being the site of in the First World War, where the troops congregated before they boarded ship.
Mm.
It was a huge camp. Because that's the First World War.
Yeah. Okay, Sally leaves. Sally walks out on you, basically. She leaves you.
No. Sally decides. I don't know. I mean, yeah, Sally persuades me that I'm impotent, and she moves into her own bedroom, and I kind of settle for it, and then eventually. A young lady comes along, 50 years younger than I, and after some months, talks me into the former girlfriend of my son, and talks me into an affair, which turns out with us living together for a few years, and of course, I move out of our house. And buy the house that I'm living in now and get a divorce. And, of course, Sally or Sari is furious with me because of the younger woman, because she was involved with my son. We're now on a more or less friendly basis, Sari and I. She's sold that house and moved up to the country in Saugerties.
So what's the date of the divorce, 2002?
Which?
The date of your divorce from Sally, 2002? I'm just guessing.
Let me look.
I met you in 2000, so I guess it was after that. I even met your girlfriend at one point in there.
Simone?
Yes.
Or Jane. There's been a series of them. Divorce. Let's see. Divorce. Hey,
you're looking in your filing cabinet?
Yes.
Do you do these interviews with us, dialogue standing by the filing cabinet?
Filed? No, I just happened to have it right next to my desk, 1999.
Oh, okay. So that means this whole thing with the young girl is in 96, 97.
No. Well, maybe 98. Yeah.
98, right. And that's right after Bancroft, after the interview in 96.
All right.
Okay, so the next thing is, when does the art world decide to start remembering your work in the 60s? Is that by 2002? Because you've been doing this for about 5 years, haven't you? Going around to museums and having retrospectives.
Well, I don't know. I haven't really had a retrospective. We did a thing at Anthology Film Archives, right?
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, that was early on.
That's like 2004, I think.
2004, 2005. Is it? Let's see. I can look it up, but I don't know.
But I think you had done something before that. What do you think is the reason, other than cyclicals of art history?
Yeah, well, yeah, I did a show at the Vorpal Gallery in 2002 in San Francisco.
And what did the show consist of?
Old pieces and some new pieces.
And it was just you, or was Michael involved, too?
No, Michael was involved, but it was basically my show.
So why was that done? Who asked you?
I don't know. It was the gallery. It involved Isaac Abrams, who's a friend of mine and an artist.
Yeah, I met him, yes. It was at Woodstock.
Yeah. And, I don't know, yeah, it grew like that. And I was making new collages, and I was writing more poetry, and it kind of...
What did you think of the internet mania, the mid-90s? Did you have any involvement with getting websites or anything in the internet world as it exploded after 95 for the masses?
Not really at that time. I mean, I was using computers because, of course, after my son Zalman got involved, I was...
He'd keep you up. He'd tell you what was going on, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's the one who did the Photoshop we were talked about before.
Right.
So here you are. The Internet's happening. You're still doing the cheese. Did we say when you got out of the cheese business? When did you do that?
About the time of the divorce.
Okay, late 90s.
Yeah.
So I met you in August 2000, and you were... I heard you on Bob Fast. Now, you've been on Bob Fast many times since 2000, but I think you hadn't been on his show or on WBI for a long time before 2000. Am I right?
I don't know. He and I have been friends. See, the anthology was 2005.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking, 2004, 2005. But let's talk about Bob Fast, because he's an interesting person in New York counterculture history, and he's done a lot. How did you first meet him? Did he know of your work with the Billy disc and that kind of stuff you're doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I came to New York, back from California, of course, WBAI was, the Pacifica Foundation affiliate here.
Yeah, the early 60s. And I'll just say that Bob Fast was recently, about a year ago, I guess, written up in New Yorker magazine.
There's a film being made about him. And
yes.
Yeah. And by Paul Lovelace. And which I've been involved with. But he was one of the few people on radio who kind of reflected what Lou Hill and the rest of us at KPFA had thought about as radio, as listener-sponsored culture, centered radio. And we have mutual friends, Paul Krasner,
Bob Dylan. Dylan was a mutual friend or acquaintance.
Well, yeah, you might say that.
Well, Bob Fass, he has tapes of...
I don't think Bill Dylan would ever have considered himself a friend of mine, but he certainly knew me.
Right, and Bob Fass presented some of the earliest recordings of Dylan, gave him the radio airplay, and interviewed him.
Not just Dylan, but most of the folk singers of the time.
Most everybody, yeah.
But also,
in that in those early years.
Yeah, and he and his and he was an activist, involved in a lot of, you know, protests and things. And I knew his wife well at the time. I mean, it's not the same wife.
Right.
In fact, I saw her recently at his birthday party.
His first wife.
Yep.
Now, didn't you? I think he said once to me, or maybe on the radio, that you turned him on to McLuhan. I think.
Yeah, it's quite possible. But I mean, we used to hang out in his studio during the ESCO days.
And where was that? You remember the address?
Yeah, Proximal. Church building.
You mean the the studio for WBAI, not his personal studio. Okay.
Yeah, we used to hang out at his apartment also. And it was on, what was it, 3rd Avenue, I think, or 2nd Avenue.
In the village, in the teens?
No, a little higher.
Okay. So how did Bob seem at that point? Was he feeling his cultural power? Was he arrogant? He doesn't seem that way now.
He's not an arrogant guy.
No.
He was...
Excited? He had energy?
He had lots of energy, and he was a very exciting personality on the radio. I think he's quieted down a lot, actually.
Yeah, Paul Kass.
Not philosophically or conceptually, but
the mixing
voice-wise.
Yeah.
And
you know, Paul Krasner says that Bob Fass is the champion of dead air.
Dead air is very interesting. I got somebody really mad at me up in your Canadian homeland.
Yeah.
He was an arrogant guy who was interviewing me. And every time he asked me a question, I opened my mouth and nothing came out. And then as soon as he would try and, you know, say something, I would say something. And the next time he'd ask a question, I'd do the same thing. He screamed like hell at me when we got off the air.
He kept falling into the gap. And then you'd overlap.
You're not supposed to have any dead air.
What network was this? Can you recall the person?
No, I have no idea.
Is this a long time ago?
Yeah.
Okay. So Bob Fass, you're hanging out with him. You're a key friend, a close friend of his, right?
Yep.
And did you keep coming on his radio show in the 70s and 80s? Or was, I felt in 2000 it had been many years had passed you hadn't seen him.
Yeah, probably not since the 70s.
Wow, that's a long time. And you did know about his when he got fired from WBAI, and then he got very unhappy, and he said he was pretty grumpy at one point.
Even some of the time we didn't see each other, there were some women involved on both sides, and there was period when he wasn't very well and unhappy, but there were periods during which we talked, even though I didn't go on the radio. Yeah.
So, Billy record, was that inspired by what he was doing, or you would have?
No, the Billy Master was done in 1963 by Michael and I, and it was later updated a little bit and cleaned up, but it was mostly stuff from the KPFA files.
Right. So he would have heard it by the time you made it.
No, he didn't hear it until we came to New York.
Right, but he'd already been doing at least mixing voices and sounds. He was thinking that way himself.
Lots of people were.
Yeah.
Even other people on BAI. Remember the name of the guy in that.
Steve Post? Was he one of those guys? I don't know.
Yeah, Steve was doing some stuff, but that was not who I was thinking of. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Okay, so let's talk about Paul Krasner. Did you know about Mad Magazine, what he did in the Realist? Were you reading The Realist?
Yes.
when it first started in the late 50s?
I don't know about the 50s. Later on, I mean, we were friends after I came to New York. I haven't seen him in years.
Right, but you mean you saw him in the early 60s. You met him around the same time you met Bob Fass.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you think of
separately.
Separately, yeah. What did you think of the Yippie movement that they started in late 67? Were you aware of that and interested?
Well, I mean, you mean Abby and...
And Bob Fass and Paul Krasner.
Well, Abby and Jerry, really.
Okay, but Krasner was, and Fass were at those early meetings.
Yes, they were.
And so was Walter Bowert.
Yes, Walter was around. But it was, you know, it was the creation of Jerry and Abby. And I was never too happy about either one of them.
And why would you say that? You knew too much about their personal lives? Or you didn't like their politics? Or
They were aggressive and assertive.
Right. The
which neither Paul or Bob were.
I right.
They were public, you know, but that's different.
Yeah, they weren't screaming for the spotlight.
Jerry was worse than Abby.
Yeah. So back to this revival.
I had my problems with them.
Yeah, see, you react to the people's personalities.
But when we did Woodstock, they wanted to do the security, and we had...
You're talking about the famous festival in 69?
Yes.
You were involved with that? The organization?
We did the logistics, yes. Intermediate Systems Corporation.
Okay. And they wanted...
They came to us and wanted to do the security, and we said we already hired the Hog Farm, you know, Wavy Gravy and his bunch.
Yes.
And they said, well, if you don't pay us, we'll make trouble for you. I said to them, Abby and Jerry, go ahead, make some trouble. Do your best.
Then he eventually got bopped on the jaw by Pete Townsend of The Who. That's Abby. Got hit. You remember that?
No.
He went up on stage and tried to talk politics, so Pete Townsend hit him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I don't remember that, but I'm sure you're right.
So you were there for those 3 or 4 days in the middle of it?
I left the day before the end because I saw that it was going to be practically impossible to leave. I actually had 40 people working there. I left with me and Sarah, or Sally at the time.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that before. I don't think that's in the Bancroft history. So you were part of the infrastructure of Woodstock. Did you have
a
feeling?
Mike Lang, who was the, you know...
Yeah, the promoter,
the
main guy on the business level.
Mike Lang used to buy psychedelic posters from us when he had a head shop in Florida when he was at the university there. Mike lives in Woodstock.
You still see him?
Yeah, once in a while.
Well, did he personally make a lot of money from the movie?
No. Oh, from the movie, yes. We didn't get paid until the movie hit. It was really rough. Cost us a lot of money. We had a British architect working there, and we did all the signage.
All the what?
Signage. And we laid out the place, and then of course, 10 days before, we had to move it.
Yeah. So, how many miles was that?
Yeah, too many.
I mean, so how long was it planned? You know, the first part, before he moved it, was that planned 2 months, 6 months, or 2 weeks
before?
Yeah,
just 2 or 3 months, yeah.
With Michael Lang. Lang or whatever.
Yeah, and the two people who put up the money.
And who were they?
Two Jewish guys from Long Island who, pretty nice guys. Can't remember their names. I'm sure you can find it.
Yeah, the Woodstock Arts and Crafts Festival, whatever it was called, was a tradition going on for years before that, right?
No, that had nothing to do with that festival.
There was that festival, because Bob Fest talks about going up to that the year before.
Yeah, but that's a completely different trip, so it had nothing to do with the Woodstock Festival.
So what were you, did you think, as part of the planning, that it would have that many people coming?
No, of course we didn't. We didn't think that there would be a fraction of those, that many people. We prepared for what they told us, what their projection was. That wasn't our job to project the audience.
And the projection was like, what, 10,000? Something like that?
Maybe, something, rational and reasonable. And, we found the people to build the stage and the sound people and, the latrines and the food people and,
That's what you did. That was your responsibility.
Yeah, we were the logistics people.
With
the fences, we had fences built.
Around the first place.
Yeah, second place too, but the second place, nobody needed fences, they just went through them.
But you built the first place, and then you had to take it all down and take it to that guy's farm.
Yes, right.
You remember the guy's name? Is it Max Yasger? It's just a name.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, Max Yasger. So you go to the farm, that's a headache, but you guys are up all night probably doing it, right?
Yes.
Second phase. Another headache. More schlepping, right? Schlepping art.
Lots of schlepping, right. We put up a geodesic dome for ourselves.
Yeah.
To sleep in, made out of hula hoops. And duct tape and plastic thrown over it. And, you understand that it was a sea of mud.
Yeah, but is that wasn't the first day, though, was it? I don't think so.
It was pretty much from near the very beginning, yeah.
Okay, so here it is the day before. You're rushing to finish it. Do you get it ready in time?
No, of course not.
Okay. So then the people start coming, and what are you doing? Run around hammering things as the people start?
Well, me personally?
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell 40 people what to do.
Okay.
And in the meantime, it's obvious nobody's going to pay. except the people who bought tickets ahead of time.
And there it is again, no money again. I mean, you're thinking of that. You're not going to be able to pay these people, right?
Oh, we paid our people.
Ah, okay. And that gives us a time for the date of Intermedia. We had not brought this up when we were going through the chronology. So Intermedia does this in 69. So what was your sense? Had it been around for 2 years, say, Intermedia?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it started...
We know what the dates of Intermedia. I mean, we were incorporated at a certain date. And we went bankrupt at a certain date.
Right, so I think it starts in 67 then.
Probably right.
Yeah. So all these people streaming in. Are you thinking, damn, no one's going to pay? Are you bugged by that?
No, we were thinking, hey, let's get our act together because this is going to be some fantastic event,
And that was exciting?
It was very exciting for everybody. Of course it was.
Did you smoke a lot of grass?
We weren't in charge of the money.
Yeah, right. You weren't.
I mean, we had gotten some, some money in advance, but we had capital in Intermedia, so that we weren't worried about the money. We were worried about not having enough toilets and not having enough food, and eventually we were worried about health, and, we didn't wind up having to take care of a lot of stuff because things got too complicated. I mean, we weren't booking the musicians, you know?
Yeah.
And somebody else was in charge of dismantling and rebuilding the stage and putting the sound systems and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But when it came down to it, some of the musicians had to be flown in by helicopter, right?
Yeah.
We didn't do that. That wasn't our job. And, you know, then some sick people had to be flown out.
Okay, so it's... Are you smoking grass or doing acid during those 4 days?
I'm certainly smoking grass.
Okay, so the first few hours, a lot of people, it's going to be exciting. Then starts to rain. Does that bother you?
Oh, certainly bothered us. I mean, it made everything more difficult. It made everything more difficult for everybody. I went to sleep one night and in this tent right in the center of this geodesic dome with these hula hoops, and I woke up in the morning with this incredible bright light, and I finally kind of looked and I saw, and what had happened is that in the center hoop, the water had gathered in it, and this kind of bulb of plastic was hanging down from the center hula hoop right over my head. And the light from the sun was shining right through it and focused like a lens, you know, on me. So I quickly moved out from under it because I figured eventually it would break and all the water would come pouring down, you know. I mean, this British architect had built this funny geodesic dome for us made out of hula hoops and put together with duct tape. I mean, can you see it?
Yeah. And
I mean, it was probably 40 feet in diameter.
If it had broken, could the water, if it came right down on you, would that have hurt? Would that have damaged you?
It could have. You know.
The force.
Yeah.
Could have shocked you, given you a heart attack.
It could have been done something. But anyway, I woke up in time. So, you know, but like the day before the end, that afternoon, we took our car with, you know, we had official badges and things, and we got out. By that time, the police were omnipresent, not on the ground.
Yeah.
But outside.
So when you get back home, which would be back in
Woodstock.
You went back to Woodstock?
Sure.
Yes.
Woodstock was quite far.
How many miles from Yasgur's farm? I mean, time-wise.
Well, a lot. I mean, Yasgur's farm is more like near Middletown.
Okay. So you get back home, and then there's this media coverage for the next few days. What did you think of that? I mean, what are the thoughts? You were saying, well, it was pretty fantastic.
We thought, in one sense, that it was like bullshit that it had happened like that. Spending 3 days in the mud and, wondering about how all our people were. And,
you have a bit of a responsibility towards it.
And having to clean up. Well, Stuart Badockler, who I'm still friendly with, was our treasurer, and he was there in charge.
He was in charge of what?
Of everything. I mean,
on the financial level.
Yeah, and well, also on the operational level, I was just the president. I was the creative head of the company.
So he had a tough time, you're saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, then it had to be cleaned up. We didn't do it, but I mean, the cleanup was incredible.
Were you assigned to do the cleanup before it happened?
No.
No, that wasn't your responsibility.
No, we helped, but, you know, it was, and it never really was totally cleaned up.
Mm. Now, you got go ahead.
Left that place in a fucking mess.
Yeah.
Now there's a museum. They never contacted me, which is just as well.
You mean they never have, they don't have your story about it in the museum?
No. And I'm not even sure that they got a hold of Michael. I don't mean Callahan, I mean Lang.
Right. You don't think they got a hold of him? Is that what you said?
No, I heard that they hadn't.
So they
avoided it.
But see, this is interesting because, you know, reading McLuhan, and you have this mass media archetypal event that becomes a sign for a generation, and you're inside the event. Think about the inside view, and then the mass media legacy, the icon. What thoughts do you get? Because that's media stuff. That's collective poetry. You know.
Well, I mean, you know, it was so much more than a concert. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, the concert was a minor part of what was going on. I mean, the campsites were all over the mountain, you know?
Yeah.
And they were, in a sense, you might even say they were independent of the concert. You could hear it. You certainly couldn't see it. And there were people, you know, doing crafts. There were people doing drugs. There were people listening to music, you know. People were camping. It was like a global village.
Right. You know what McLuhan called Woodstock? Instant City.
Yeah, he's right.
Yeah, Instant City.
It was amazing. I mean, just walking around, and it was crowded. I mean, you could barely weave your way through it, right?
For miles.
I was much more fascinated with that than by the concert.
Yeah, by the formation of an Instant City.
Yeah. And the wild people. I would wander around and sit down with some people, and, you know, and of course you bump into people you knew from all over the country.
So that'd be fun.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, when it wasn't raining too hard, it was fun.
What do you say? You have any comments on how Wavy Gravy handled his responsibilities for the hog farm?
It did very well. You know, they adapted to the conditions that happened. They were kind. They weren't tough in any way, except, you know, once in a while when they had to be. They were great. And Wavy is a fantastic human being.
Yeah, now, Abbie Hoffman, he and Reuben make these threats. From your consciousness, they didn't do anything. They didn't make trouble, did they?
No, not really. I mean, maybe they thought they did, but I mean, what could the few of them do in a mass crowd like that? You know, there was nothing to be done.
You know what, Frank Zappa, he was interviewed a month or so later in Rolling Stone or someplace, and he said, I don't know why he didn't go. I don't know if he was invited, but he said that Woodstock was the turning point, the sign that youth culture was now big business. That's how he analyzed it.
I think he was wrong. It wasn't big business.
It was the effect of television. It was a generation coming together and expressing themselves at the end of a decade.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really very gentle. I mean, there were some thefts, and there were, you know, some births. And,
like in any community or city?
Yeah. But it was a very, very nice feeling, actually.
Were the Hells Angels there at that one?
There were some, but, I mean, there were no big trips with the Hells Angels.
Yeah, because a few months later, they do Altamont.
Yeah, they were bikers, but, you know, there weren't any moments of real threat or paranoia. I mean, we were paranoid afterwards, because the people who put it, the two guys who put it on, and Michael, were not communicative at all with us.
So why would that make you paranoid? What are you paranoid about?
About getting paid.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And you didn't get paid for a couple of years then, because the movie doesn't come out for a year or two.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, I wouldn't say it was paranoid. You were angry.
You know, business. Well, I mean, we understood the situation, but what we didn't like was them not communicating. We understood that they didn't have the money, but, you know, we were in touch with them hour by hour for so much time, and we, you know, we did everything we were supposed to do. I mean, I don't have any of the signage. Michael has some. But, you know, all those artifacts are worth a fortune these days.
And Michael has some.
Yeah. Michael Callahan.
Yeah, he should put them on eBay, and then you guys split the profit.
Right. He values stuff like that. He's a collector.
Oh, okay. And, okay, so the, you were staying at the first Woodstock site for a week or two, living there. I mean, this is like a month-long thing in total of the time you put into it, right?
Well, I don't remember. I was certainly there the week before. I'm not sure, about 2 weeks.
Mm.
But, you know, and it didn't rain until after it started. Yeah, I mean, from the time that we moved, yeah, you're right.
And you had to plan beforehand. I mean, you put a lot of energy, time.
Yeah, but I mean, I wasn't personally, you know, like I told you, we had this architect, a really nice guy, young guy, architect from England.
I was going to ask you, was he part of that creative avant-garde architectural movement? I forget the name. I saw a retrospective of him a couple of years ago.
There was
a school in England.
I'm not sure that he was part of the school, but he was definitely. He lived for a while in Woodstock and in Cambridge, and we knew him. And he did a very good job.
Well, why was he hired? Did people take bids? Did Michael Lang take?
No, we hired him. Intermediates. He was worked for us.
And why? How did you find him? Why did
he was a friend of ours.
All right, so you knew he was talented, so.
Yes.
When did...
And we had a guy who did the signs, who silkscreened them. And, you know, for the latrines, and, you know...
Yeah.
In and out, and all that stuff.
How many months before did the idea first get floated? Can you remember?
I don't remember how many months, but it was months.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, we went back. That's a good digression. We missed that totally. I didn't know you had done that. So, back to your father. We were talking about his personality and how he, you didn't say it, but it's in the Bancroft transcript, how he represented that old generation that didn't really communicate with their kids. And then you talk about how you and your generation had a bit more open relationship with your children.
That's true.
Compare your father and what you were trying to connect with. And does that still affect you?
Sure. My father and my mother, my stepmother, who's still alive, have never had any idea of who I was or what I represented in the world. They had some kind of, you know, symbolic inkling, but, you know, it wasn't part of their lives, and my father didn't like it, and he wanted me, you know, to be different. And she still tells me that I need to get a haircut, you know.
She still does say that.
Yes.
Well, how old is she? She's
95.
Beg your pardon?
95.
95. So the that, as an 80-year-old person, that still niggles at you about your...
No, it doesn't niggle at me because I don't pay any attention to it. I wear my hair that I want to wear the way I want to wear it. I'm wearing it longer and longer these days.
No, I mean the incompletion with your parents.
I tried to complete things with my father, even with the advice of my rabbi, Zalman Schachter. And it never worked, because he wasn't willing. On the other hand, I held his hand when he died. and I was there alone with them because my mother and my stepbrother were out trying to find somebody to revive him, and my stepmother was very angry when she came back and he died when she wasn't around.
Right, know? Yeah.
It was his fault, right? and he was ready to go, and I was very happy when he went, you know, because I didn't want to be revived. He didn't want to be revived. He was in a lot of pain, and he was ready, you know. But she wasn't ready for him to go.
But the...
And she's not ready to go now.
Right. Would you say that that older generation was more afraid of death than our generation or the younger kids?
Absolutely.
Do you have any theories why that was? It was just cultural conditioning? They didn't have acid?
Well, that may be true, but I certainly didn't have that. First of all, they is too big.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from people who were refugees, you know.
Yeah.
And refugees are congenitally paranoid. They're congenitally manipulative, and they have a great need to be successful in their, you know, in wherever they wound up, if it's at all possible. Some of them never make it.
Right.
But a lot of them make it. You know, and some of them make it very big, as you know. Like my schoolmate, Mr. Kissinger.
Was he, he'd be a few, he was born in 1923, I think.
Yeah, he was two classes ahead of me at PS 187 Manhattan.
And do you remember him? Did we talk? We didn't talk about him, did we?
I don't know. I don't
you and I have, but not on tape. So what do you have? What do you recall about him?
He wasn't well-liked, and he had a brother who, I can't remember if his brother was older or younger than him, but his brother also was very successful, I think, an electronic manufacturer. They didn't take very good care of their parents. His mother and my stepmother's mother, my grandmother, were in the catering business together.
And so you knew all about the kids from your stepmother as it was happening.
No, I knew his mother better than I knew him.
And so they weren't liked because. Well, what would you say?
He was an arrogant kid.
Was he a nerd in sense, a bookworm? And you know?
I really don't know. You know, he didn't have as big an accent as he has now.
Well, he started working for the Fourth Reich, so he had to acquire the accent. That's what Mae Brussel used to joke about.
It's odd, 'cause, you know, I mean, he was older than I was when he arrived.
Yes. And, okay, so he's a kid, he's not liked, you're younger, you notice that the kids don't like him. You can remember that.
Yeah.
And you didn't like him, and...
Well, I didn't know him that well, but he wasn't part of our group, you know?
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have let him in.
So did you know where he went? Did you lose track of him by the time you were in high school?
Yeah, I lost track of him. I don't even know where he went to high school. I went to Bronx Science and then William Howard Taft.
Yeah, so he's in a junior, what we call a junior high school with you.
No, in PS 187, the public school.
Like grade 6?
We didn't even have junior high schools. We went first through 8th grade.
Oh, okay, so you saw him when he was in the 8th grade.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, then he goes to a high school, and you don't know where he goes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But, I mean, I may have known him earlier.
No, that's what I mean, but that would be the last point. Grade 8 would be...
Yeah, and I would have been in grade 6.
Okay, so when do you first hear of him again? When he's secretary, whatever he was under Nixon?
No, I think through my grandmother, before she died. Because she was friendly with his mother.
So she probably said he went to Harvard. You probably knew that.
Yeah, whatever.
And that's where he met Fritz Kramer, who was, I don't know if you could say double agent, but he'd worked for Hitler. And Mae Brussel makes a lot out of Fritz Kramer. And Peter Drucker, you ever heard of him?
Sure.
Drucker wrote a book called Adventures of a Bystander in 1979. He talks about his life with Bucky Fuller and with Marsh McLuhan. And he's the one who got Fritz Kramer to come to America in the late 30s, and he became a trainer of soldiers, and maybe intelligence, because he knew German, at some camp in the Arkansas or someplace. And he was eventually taken over to Germany, or, you know, 44 into 45, and he was at the Battle of the Bulge, dealing with the... getting the German scientists, the ones who were going to defect to the United States, and Henry Kissinger was an underling of his there.
Oh, I see.
And then Fritz Kramer goes on to be the head guy in the Pentagon for decades. You know, behind the scenes, the think tank guy, the strategic guy. And Drucker writes a pretty interesting essay. If you ever check out the book, Adventures of a Bystander, it's interesting. He first saw McLuhan in 1940-41, and he said he heard McLuhan say the medium's message, not those words, but that idea was imparted in, you know, very innocent early forms in that lecture, and then they became friends. And then Drucker used a lot of McLuhan's stuff, watered down. But his essay on Fritz Kramer and the importance he was to Henry Kissinger is called Fritz Kramer, the Man Who Invented Henry Kissinger. And he was a top German Nazi who was put in the dock before Nuremberg, but for some reason was able to become an American and work both sides. Anyways, Kissinger, you wouldn't know anything about that. The grandmother didn't hear about it, but he shows up in your consciousness. I think he's National Security Director. That kind of level in the first Nixon administration in 69. You know, he's on the world stage when you're at Woodstock. Now, mm-hmm. did you notice him at that point?
Yeah, sure.
And were you must have been amazed.
Yes, I was.
you're the little kid from your school. But then what he's symbolic of as a jerk and asshole.
Yeah, because, you know, Henry... kids who were German, who were Henry, they weren't really named Henry.
No.
They were named Heinz.
Yeah. So that's a strange thing right there.
I had a cousin named Heinz who became Henry.
So you're saying that Henry Kissinger was not named Heinz?
Was probably named Heinz, yes.
But he dropped it and developed his accent, so...
Well, I mean, I was called Jack, you know.
Yeah.
In public school.
Why is that?
My father changed my name to Jack when he registered me, because he didn't think Garrett was, you know, something that Americans could pronounce or would want to.
Right. Yeah, looking up Kissinger, he was born Heinz Alfred Kissinger.
Ah, see? And now he's... I've been kind of interested in having a residence at the American Academy in Berlin, and Mr. Kissinger is on the board of directors. So when I was shown the place, they said, "Oh, and one of our directors is Henry Kissinger." I said, "No, I went to public school with him," and they looked at me as if I was crazy.
So he becomes, his birthday is May 27, 1923, but he becomes...
But he was 5 years younger, older than that. And does it say anything about his brother?
Let me go down. But, you know, it's interesting, he's 5 years older, but because he came over and all that stuff, he fell back a few grades. You know, normally...
Well, I fell back grades also.
Yeah, right. It says...
I had to make up for them in high school.
Okay, it says his surname refers to the city of Bad Kissingen.
Bad Kissingen.
Yeah, and was first taken by his great-great-grandfather, Meyer Loeb, in 1817. was taken. Okay, the name. In 1938, fleeing Nazi persecution, his family moved to New York. He was naturalized as a citizen in June 43 while in military training at Camp Croft in Spartanburg, South Carolina. That may be where he met Fritz Kramer. Well, let's see if we can get a Wikipedia in a minute on Fritz Kramer. He spent his high school years in Gerd Stern's neighborhood. They mentioned you right here in Wikipedia. He spent his high school years in the Washington Heights section of Upper Manhattan. And that's what your area was called, right? Washington Heights.
Yeah, well, he went to George Washington?
No, they say he spent his high school years in the Washington Heights.
Yeah, well, that's what the only high school in the Heights at that time was George Washington.
Yes, they have that in the next sentence. But Washington Heights is the region you're growing up in, right?
Yes, absolutely. 187th Street. He lived two blocks from me. I know that I had friends in the house. And I visited his apartment.
As a kid, you mean with your grandmother?
With my grandmother. Yeah. I used to help them make sandwiches.
Was he in the house at the time?
No, not that I remember.
Yeah, you'd be a bit younger in that sense. He never lost his pronounced German accent, they say. Perhaps due to childhood shyness, which made him hesitant to speak. Did he speak a lot in what you saw?
I never thought of him as shy.
Yeah, he was arrogant.
That's what I thought. But maybe shyness can come across as arrogance.
Right, but was he physically strong?
I don't think so.
Yeah. So he attended George Washington High School. Did you go to that school?
No, that's...
No, you went to Bronx High, yeah, science.
No, but that was a school for people who didn't have any smarts.
Henry Kissinger attended... Sorry. What?
That's very strange that he went to George Washington.
Well, okay, so if he has no smarts, then he's already a robotoid. He's already being programmed by the Fourth Reich Nazi guys through Kissinger to groom this guy. That would be the May Brussels scenario.
Maybe.
Henry Kissinger attended George Washington High School at night, and worked in a shaving brush factory during the day.
Ah, now that makes sense. His parents were poor.
Ah. He couldn't go to high school.
I think there was something wrong with his father. I think his father didn't work.
Mm.
I'm not sure, but you know, like I say, his mother and my grandmother were partners in a catering business. They catered for parties, mostly for musicians and conductors, Toscanini, Heifetz, that whole crowd.
And you said your stepmother? And the grandmother.
Oh, my stepmother's mother.
And and his mother. And Kissinger's mother. Not
Helga.
Grandmother, Kissinger's mother.
Mother,
yeah.
Helga.
Helga. this is probably further down. Okay, so it says, so that means he couldn't afford to go to high school and he attended on his own, or he...
Well, no, I mean, that's high. The high school is free.
Okay, but he had to work to
keep. He had to work to help support his family.
But he had enough smarts to go to school to think he should keep going to school. You know.
Yeah, how he got into Harvard is a question. Was it after the Army?
Yeah, it says while attending City College of New York in 1943.
Yeah.
And that's
CCNY.
Yeah. Now, what if he come over in 38? I mean, when. Where, how, what year are you in grade 6? Is that about 1940? Oh, no, yeah, 1939?
38? No, I don't know.
Well, okay, how old? Okay, born 1928, you, in grade 6 you'd be 12, but you fell back, so you're actually 14, not 1942. That doesn't make sense, so how would that work?
How can he have gone to City College in 1943.
Right. So you agree that you would have been in grade 6 in 41 or 42, something like that, during the war, or when you're going into war?
I don't know.
Maybe we're uncovering something here. While attending City College, he was drafted into the U.S. Army, trained at Clemson College in South Carolina, became a German interpreter. Ah, there it is. German interpreter for the 970th Counterintelligence Corps. That's the gang that went...
What year was that?
Well, let's see. Click on it to see what year it was formed. But the Counterintelligence Corps, it says, was a World War II and early Cold War intelligence agency within the United States Army.
Mm-hmm.
Its role was taken over by the U.S. Army Intelligence Corps in 61 and in 67 by the U.S. Army Intelligence Agency. Its functions are now performed by the United States Army Intelligence and Security Command and by the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, I know, but
here's its origin. Its origins are the Corps of Intelligence Police, founded by Ralph Van Diemen in 1917. This organization...
When was he at City College?
In 43.
43. And he came in 38, so that was 5 years later?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
No, I mean, when was he at PS-187?
Okay, so he's born in 23, so he comes when he's 15, and you're seeming grade 8, which would be, grade 8 is when you're 12 and 13, normally. So he's only a couple years off, so yes, he would have lost a few years, so he's 15 in grade 8.
Maybe I only knew him when he was just about to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I say, he wasn't a friend of mine.
Well, okay, he's 15 in...
And it doesn't say anything about his brother.
Well, that'll be another section. This is just his person, probably in another part of the family, but it's a huge thing here on Wikipedia.
Oh, boy.
But if he's born in 23, he's 15 and 38, and let's say he's in grade 8 or grade 7. They put him in 7 and 39, so in 1940 he'd be grade 8. You'd be 12 in grade 8, and you'd be in 6.
Maybe. Okay.
Yeah, you'd be 12 in 1940. Okay. You'd be in grade 6 and he'd be in grade 8. That kind of works. So then then he goes and studies high school for 3 or 4 years, and then he gets into City College in 43. See, that works.
Okay. And I was in City College for about 4 or 5 weeks.
Okay. And what year was that? That'd be 45, 46, after the end of the war?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay, so he, back to the CIC... This organization,
well,
operating within the USA and on attachment to the AEF in France, at its peak numbered over 600 men. However, in the post-war period, that would be, during World War I, the policy of isolationism, retrenchment of military spending, and economic depression meant that by the 1930s, its numbers had fallen to fewer than 20 officers. The looming threat of war in the late 1930s brought an expansion of the Corps of Intelligence Police, the predecessor, back to its World War I levels, and the entry of the United States into World War II in December 41 brought an even greater expansion and a new name. In 1941, the Adjutant General of the Army issued an order renaming the CIP as the Counter...
Why do we want to go into this?
Well, these are the guys that brought the Nazis over after World War II.
Uh-huh.
With Kissinger, with Fritz Kramer as the inside man who worked with the Nazis when he was working for Hitler, and then crossed over.
We have that in our new opera.
Have what? The Project Scientist. The Project Paperclip Scientist, right?
Yeah, because they were part of the CIA group.
Right, and Henry Kissinger was one of the people who brought them over.
That's pretty wild.
Because we're talking about, let's just continue, I'll show you. It says, they changed the name to Counterintelligence Corps, effective January 1st, 42. A new complement of 543 officers and 4,431 non-commissioned agents was authorized. The CIC recruited men with legal, police, or other investigative backgrounds, and particularly looked for men with foreign language skills. That might have been why Henry got in there. However, there were never enough of these, and local interpreters were often recruited. In the European and Pacific theaters of operations, they were deployed detachments at all levels. Now, moving on, they were also involved in providing security for military installations and staging areas, located enemy agents, and acted to counter stay-behind networks, after the battles or after the war. They also provided training to combat units in security, censorship, the seizure of documents, and the dangers of booby traps. In some cases, CIC agents found themselves acting as the de facto military government on the occupation of large towns prior to the arrival of AMGOT officers. As the war in Europe came to a close, CIC were involved in the operations called ALSOS, Paperclip, and TICOM, searching for German personnel and research in atomic weapons, rockets, and cryptography. Recruits after World War II included Klaus Barbie, also known as the Butcher from Lyon, a former Gestapo member and war criminal. Okay, that's the CIC. Now go back to Kissinger. It says he's trained. He's in the College of City College of New York in 43, strapped into the army, and became a German interpreter for the 970th Counterintelligence Corps with the rank of sergeant. And that was where he got involved with Fritz Kramer. He received his BA degree, summa cum laude. That's pretty accomplished, right? Summa cum laude. Or is it magna cum laude? I don't know. I never did education in the States. What, summa cum laude, is that good?
I think so.
Let's just click on it and see what it says. Cum laude, magna cum laude, summa, with supreme honor, with supreme praise. Okay, so he becomes smart and graduates in 1950, where he studied under William Yandel Elliott. Now, Elliott is the intellectual complement to Fritz Kramer. William Yandel Elliott is like, what would you say, like Bertrand Russell or something?
Oh.
Or the guy who did the study in history, you know, the famous British historian, Arnold somebody. He received his MA and PhD degrees at Harvard University in 52, 54. That's when you're running back and forth San Francisco, California. In 52, while still at Harvard, he served as a consultant to the director of the Psychological Strategy Board. His doctoral dissertation was called Peace, Legitimacy, and Equilibrium, a study of the statesmanship of Castlereagh and Metternich. See, so he's preparing himself for the role he eventually gets, and somebody has put the idea in his mind he can do it. Yeah, he remained at Harvard as a member of the faculty in the Department of Government and at the Center for International Affairs. He became his associate director in 57. He was a consultant to the National Security Council in 1955. See, but that's through Fritz Kramer. I'm going to just see if, just go into his family if they mention his brother. Remember, we now have the trial of Henry Kissinger. He's persona non grata everywhere. Right when Garrett is being greeted by countries all over the world. Right?
Well.
People are interested in you. They're not busting you, declaring you an enemy of humanity.
Except the IRS.
Well, that's what Kissinger runs. So their battle continues between Garrett and Henry. They don't seem to have anything about his family, you know. I'm just going to see if Fritz Kramer is listed.
So where are we going next?
Okay, we're talking. Why did we get on to?
I don't know because I went to. Yeah.
Holy mackerel! You know what? They have a Fritz Kramer, but he dies in '59, and he was a German Waffen SS and officer and commander. Blah blah blah. He's the guy that. They got the fake. See, the Fritz Kramer that May Brussels talking about is here in Wikipedia, born in 1900, dies in 59. He actually didn't die. He controlled Kissinger. That's the big discovery that May Brussels made.
But
they don't. They say he died. They don't know. He died just a few years ago. He lived a very, very long life, the Fritz Kramer who ran the Pentagon.
You think he was a different one? The same one.
Okay, it says, for the American military educator Fritz Kramer, and it's spelled K-R-A-E, whereas the Nazis, K-R-A umlaut. So Fritz Kramer died on, he died today, 2003.
No, but I mean, A-E is the way.
You spell A umlaut.
Yes.
Right, and his date is July 3rd, 1908, whereas the other guy, which is the same guy, they say born in December 1900. And September 8th, 2003, Lyndon LaRouche's birthday, today, 2003, is when he died. And he really did die then, but the cover story is that he died in June 1959. Now, Mae Brussels got Seymour Hersh involved in this, and she found all the documents. Pretty interesting, her whole story of proving this. So they call him a German-American military educator and advisor. He during most of the 30s, he was senior legal advisor to the League of Nations. In 33, he married his wife, a Swedish citizen. He escaped Nazi Germany for America in 39, leaving behind his wife and son. He was drafted and became a U.S. citizen as an inductee and joined the United States Army in April 43, the same time Henry did.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a different Fritz Kramer.
No. It's the same. This is the guy I'm talking about. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. That's the famous.
No, but I mean, this is the same guy who was born in 1900.
Yes, here's the deal. At the Battle of the Bulge, the bad Nazi, the guy who died in 59, was arrested. And a deal was made somehow where he did not get executed. He sat in the dock in whatever, I don't know if it's the Nuremberg trials or whatever, but he's either going back and forth as a double agent, working both for Hitler and the Americans, because according to this history, he comes over in 43. And I'm not sure, the Battle of Bulge is in 44. And it gets obscured about what happened to him when he was in the dock. But May claims that he was actually over here and then back at the Battle of Bulge, maybe was caught, but he was a double agent. And then they let him out, and he works with the CIC, but historically they say that he didn't get out, and he was stayed in jail and then died in 59. You see, this is the interesting lie here. So he fought in the Battle of the Bulge, on the American side, they're saying, earning a battlefield commission, a Bronze Star, and the liberation of his former homeland. He returns to Washington, D.C. in 47. He left active duty in 48 and retired from the Army Reserve in 63. A gifted talent scout and teacher, he, in 1944, discovered the young Henry Kissinger, who joined his division. He discovered, okay, what was so great about Kissinger? Okay, he spoke German. In the 70s, he also discovered Alexander Haig. See, he's the guy. He's the gatekeeper who was promoted to military assistant to... Haig was promoted to as military assistant to National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. From the early 50s until 1978, when he retired from civil service, he served as a senior civilian advisor to the U.S. Army Chief of Staff in the Pentagon and influenced the Department of Defense during the Cold War. He died and was buried with full military honors in Arlington. He was honored by former Secretary of Defense James R. Schlesinger, his former students Kissinger and Haig. You see what I mean? This guy was the mentor.
Mm-hmm.
I think the present version of Fritz Kramer is a man named Andrew Marshall, if you want to check him out. So this is interesting. I mean, if people listen to this interview, Gerd, we're doing the art and culture scene, but then for having you be that close to the enemy of the art culture scene, so to speak, right? Kissinger in the political world. That's pretty Forrest Gump, Gerd.
Well, you know.
And you didn't even know that he did this or went through that phase.
And then recently I did a review of a book by Fritz Stern called Five Germanys I Have Known.
Yeah.
And
I read that review.
I met Fritz in Germany when he spoke at the Jewish Museum in Berlin.
A couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, a year or two ago, yeah. And, of course, he knew Kissinger.
And then you told him that he was your neighbor. And did he have anything to say about that? Did he tell you something about Kissinger?
No.
But he had your name. So you have Fritz Stern... is the interplay between Stern and Kissinger via Fritz Kramer. See, it's all punning, Gerd. This Forrest Gump role is a pun.
And you remember Fritz. Fritz is kind of a name that's used for German soldiers.
They're called Fritzes?
Yes.
So
anyway.
Well, when McClellan says people become their names, Fritz Kramer became the head soldier. I mean, he's the guy who created the whole design of the fighting Vietnam and the whole thing, the whole Cold War.
Well, so where are we going from here?
Okay, we were talking about your father. I don't know how we got over. Well, this Henry came up, and I'm glad it came up. And see, here's what's interesting, Garrett. You've got your role in the cultural...
Well, my father was also in the German army on the Russian front. So, and my grandfather and great-grandfather were both hussars in the German army.
Did your father talk? He didn't talk to you much, I guess, but did he talk to you about the war, his life in that world?
No, all I know is that he was given up for dead on the Russian front because they wanted to cut off his frostbitten feet and he wouldn't let them. And he still had them when he died in 95.
Right, and you mean his colleagues wanted to cut him off, and if he wasn't willing to help himself...
The medical people on the Russian front.
And if you couldn't... If you couldn't cut him off, then you couldn't move? I mean...
They thought told him he was going to die if they didn't let him cut him off. He said, no, you can't cut my feet off.
Right, good move.
When he died in 95, he had a Mercedes in the garage.
Okay, and a son reaching out to him, which he couldn't hear or see.
Yeah, well,
or he saw it in his way, but there's just such a cultural difference.
The funny thing is, like, 25, 30 years before, somebody gave me and my wife at the time a Volkswagen Bug, and my father was furious. How can you drive a German car? I never threw it up to him when he bought his Mercedes. It was too ironic.
Isn't that interesting? He could not see that.
No, it was several decades later.
Yeah, I think that, people, these like someone like that who grows up in the early part, 100 years ago, so much happened in the 20th century that they get frozen in a time warp and they can't see the things that you're talking, like that he's got a Mercedes Benz.
Yeah.
A German car. That's an American car as far as he last registered it, right? It's a sign of American wealth or something.
Yeah.
So the, now this relates to you. I mean, you looked at the effects of media. Intermedia looked into studying the effects and tried to help professors condition the kids or wake them up or study them. You were, in the cultural world, a studier of human behavior and psychology and sociology. All the things that the intelligence agencies were doing. As McLuhan said, the big discovery of the 20th century was the unconscious, and most of the intellectual resources went into mining the unconscious, studying it, how to use it, how to exploit it. It's all across the culture. So you worked with the unconscious beginning with kinetic art, or even with language, with puns, right? I mean, you were working with multi-level consciousness.
And so
let's relate this to your opera. What can you say about, the opera is about the history of MK Ultra, basically, isn't it?
Well, no, it's about the history of psychedelics. MK Ultra is only one of the scenes in it. I mean, we start out with the Oracle of Delphi.
Oracle of Delphi, and what was it called? Was it called Ergot back then, or what's the thing?
Well,
Socrates took it. I forget the word.
Well, yeah, but the oracle was the smoke that came out, of the volcanic structure, which supposedly had some kind of psychedelic effect.
The place where the oracle was, the smoke came out of what? The volcano?
Fissures in the rocks.
It was a bubbling volcano? Is that what you mean?
It was either volcanic or it had some kind of, underground smoke or heat that came out. And
listen to this, Garrett. Here's the great synchronicity.
People got hypnotized by it.
Right. Here's the great synchronicity. Just today, I was informed by Carolyn while walking to the beach that the reason Maui has such interesting health effects on people is because it's the volcanic lava. And the lava stone has... She went and had a fantastic masseuse here, so she was there yesterday, and the masseuse was rubbing lava stone on her, and she asked why. And the woman said that the stone has all these minerals in it and come from way down there in the earth, And this magnetic emanation or whatever comes out of these lava stones really helps our bodies. And the reason Maui has this incredible health effect, and I've felt it being here since June, is the emanations from the lava stones. So this relates exactly something about coming out of the volcano.
Yeah, but you know, we go into Castaneda and we go into Artaud and we go into Maria Sabina and, you know, the loose
Gordon Wasson story. The Gordon Wasson.
Exactly, the Wasson story and the Luces, who were Wasson's friends and took psychedelics, you know, and made a big deal about it in life.
Yeah.
And then we go into Kennedy doing LSD in the White House with his mistress Mary Meyer through...
Mary Meyer Pinchot, right? Mary Meyer
right.
Pinchot, yeah.
Acid, who, you know, was acid provided by Timothy. And, you know, then we do the MK Ultra.
With Sidney Gottlieb. Sidney Gottlieb.
With Gottlieb, yes, exactly. And then Gottlieb, at the very end of the opera, you know, becomes this hippie guru after he went over and took care of the lepers. I mean, it's a fantastic story.
That's not really what happened to Gottlieb.
Yes, it is what happened to Gottlieb.
He became a hippie guru?
Yes. What happened to him is he had to go up in front of Congress and testify. He got fired, right? And he kind of wanted to give back, so he went and worked at a leper colony. And then he came back to the States and he founded this little commune in Virginia, I think it was. And they took acid.
Now that would be, I never knew that. That would be in the 70s.
Ed Rosenfeld did the research.
Yeah, it's not talked about at all. I mean, when did he get in trouble? When the MK Ultra stuff comes out in the mid 70s.
Yeah, right after that he got into trouble. Of course, you know, it was after Kennedy was assassinated, and then Mary Meyer was assassinated, and then the story of her ex-husband and her brother-in-law meet in her apartment because they're both trying to get a hold of her diary, which supposedly had the JFK stuff in it. And we have that scene in it. And then we have, you know, the Trips Festival and the and Harvard with the chapel scene and the prison scene with Tim, you know, giving the prisoners and the...
Right.
It's 10 scenes in the opera.